laughter everywhere. Ooh, yes, I know some hide their joy, while others wear their cheer. But it's the miracle of Christmas.
Afternoon. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am DJ Safikar. We're broadcasting not far from where the village of Putatoy once stood, inhabited by Patwin Native Americans. Today we're looking at psychopolitics, neoliberalism, and new technologies of power by Byung-Chul Han, published in 2017. We have looked at the first seven chapters in the past couple of weeks. Today we're going to continue. Han's Psychopolitics is about the big data revolution. It's a work of cultural criticism. It's about what is happening to us and around us. Every age and epoch brings its own changes. Currently, big data is radically transforming the way we live and work. Corporations are conducting mass surveillance and data mining. And they're engaging in psychological steering so that they can predict and manipulate us for profit and market domination. They want the human psyche to be predictable and easily amendable. They want to colonize our modes of self-expression and individuality. Google AI knows what you want before you think it. What is at stake here is our disappearing freedom and what is happening to our psyche or soul. What is worrying is that under this new mutation of capitalism, individuals experience their own subjugation as liberation. So tonight we're going to look at chapter 8. It's called Friendly Big Brother. What Han means, as he has been saying all along, is that neoliberalism is a system of domination and exploitation with a smile and pat on the back. Newspeak is the name for the ideal language in George Orwell's surveillance state. It is meant to replace old speak entirely. Newspeak has only one goal, to restrict room for thinking freely. Every year, words decrease in numbers, and the space for conscious thought diminishes. Han argues that on this score, Orwell's surveillance state differs fundamentally from the world of digital panopticon, which uses freedom to access. Today's society of information is not categorized by destroying words, but by multiplying them without end. We are very chatty. The spirit of the Cold War and the negativity of enmity dominated Orwell's novel. The country it describes is in a state of permanent war. Orwell's surveillance state employs the psychotechnological methods of brainwashing, electroshock, sleep deprivation, solitary confinement, drugs, and physical torture. The Ministry of Plenty sees to it that consumer goods are always lacking, so that an artificial state of need may be maintained. Hunt maintains that Orwell's surveillance state, with its telescreens and torture chambers, is fundamentally different from today's digital panopticon, with its internet, smartphones, and Google Glass. In the digital panopticon, the illusion of limitless freedom and communication predominates. Here, there is no torture, just tweets and posts. Nor is there a mysterious ministry of truth. Transparency and information have taken the place of truth. The new conception of power does not invoke controlling the past, but steering the future psychopolitically. Hahn claims that the neoliberal technology of power does not prohibit, protect, or repress. Instead, it prospects, permits, and projects. Consumption is not held in check, but maximized. No production of scarcity occurs. Instead, surplus is generated. Indeed, a superabundance of positivity. Everyone is encouraged to communicate and consume. The principal negative needs are not repressed, but stimulated. Hahn contends that confession obtained by force has been replaced by voluntary disclosure. Smartphones have been substituted for torture chambers. Big Brother now wears a friendly face. His friendliness is what makes surveillance so efficient. The inhabitants of today's digital panopticon never really feel they're being watched or threatened. Consequently, surveillance state is an imprecise name for describing the digital panopticon. The digital panopticon lacks a Big Brother wresting information from us against our will. Instead, we lay ourselves bare voluntarily. The digital panopticon thrives on its occupants' voluntary self-exposure. Self-exploitation and self-illumination follow the same logic. In either case, freedom is exploited. Now, communication and control have become one, without remainder. Now everyone is his or her own panopticon. This is a part of the postmodern tradition, to end the chapter with some flair or something witty or poetic. The next chapter is called Emotional Capitalism. Here Hahn argues that neoliberalism is redefining us as emotional beings so that it may dominate and exploit us better and more efficiently. Hahn begins by pointing out that currently talk of feeling and emotion has grown inflationary. Many academic disciplines are researching emotion. All of a sudden, the human being no longer counts as a rational, as an animal rationale. Instead, man is a creature of sentiment. But according to Hahn, hardly anyone bothers to ask where this sudden interest in emotion came from. Hahn argues that above all, the emotional boom stems from an economic process. However, Hahn argues that a complete conceptual confusion prevails because many scholars and researchers use emotion, feeling, affect interchangeably. Hahn points out that feeling and emotions are not identical. Affect and emotion refer to strictly subjective matters, whereas feeling refers to something objective. Feeling can be recounted. It has narrative length or breadth. Neither affect nor emotion admit an account. The crisis of feelings that can be observed in contemporary theater also represents a crisis of giving account. Today, the narrative theater of feelings is yielding to a clamorous theater of effects. Because narrative is lacking, an effective mask gets piled onto the stage. But in contrast to feeling, effect does not open up space. Instead, it steers a linear path in order to discharge, to unload itself. The digital medium is an effect medium too. Digital communication fosters the immediate release of effect, catharsis. Simply on the basis of its temporality, digital communication conveys effect more than it transmits feelings. Chest storms are streams of effect. They represent exemplary phenomena of digital communication. Excuse me. Feelings are constitutive. They are declarative. For instance, we say, I have a feeling that. In contrast, it's impossible to say, I have an effect or an emotion that. Emotions are not constitutive, but performative. They refer to actions and deeds. Furthermore, they're intentional and goal-oriented. Feelings, on the other hand, do not necessarily display an intentional structure. Often, the feelings of anxiety has no concrete object. That is, what makes anxiety different from fear, which has an intentional structure. Neither emotion nor effects achieve the dimensions that characterize feelings. Emotions and effects are expressions of subjectivity. Hahn argues that feelings also have a different temporality than emotion. They admit duration. Emotions prove significantly more fleeting and short-lived than feelings. Likewise, effect is often limited to a single moment. In contrast to feelings, emotions do not represent a state. The emotion does not stand. There is no emotion of rest. A feeling of calm is easy to conceive. In contrast, the expression emotional state has a paradoxical ring. Emotions are dynamic, situative, and performative. Emotional capitalism exploits precisely these qualities. Feelings, in contrast, cannot be readily exploited inasmuch as they have no performativity. Finally, effects are not performative as much as eruptive. They lack performative directionality. Hahn then takes a critical look at Eva Illouz's Cold Intimacy, The Making of Emotional Capitalism. Hahn complains that this work offers no answer to the question of why it is that feelings in particular experience a boom under conditions of capitalism. What is more, the book equates feelings and emotion without drawing any conceptual distinction at all. Hahn is critical of Illouz for locating the question of feelings under capitalism at its inaugural stages and in the works of Max Weber. Hahn worries that what Weber analyzes is the ascetic capitalism of accumulation, which obeys rational logic more than it follows emotional logic. Accordingly, capitalism of this sort does not feed into consumer capitalism, which drives its profit from emotion. Moreover, consumer capitalism operates through the selling and consumption of meanings and emotion. It is not use value, but emotive and cultive value that play a constitutive role in the economy of consumption. By the same token, Illouz fails to account for the fact that emotions come to possess value for capitalism only when a switch to immaterial production occurs. Emotions have become a means of production only in our own times. Clearly, Hahn writes, Illouz has failed to notice that the boom of emotion in our times ultimately drives from neoliberalism. The neoliberal regime deploys emotion as resources in order to bring about heightened productivity and achievement. Starting at a certain level of production, rationality, which is the medium of disciplinary society, hits a limit. Henceforth, it is experienced as a constraint. An inhibition. Suddenly it seems rigid and inflexible. At this point, emotionality takes its place, which is attended by the feeling of liberty, the free unfolding of personality. After all, being free means giving free rein to emotions. Emotional capitalism banks on freedom. It hails emotion as the expression of unbridled subjectivity. Neoliberal technologies of power exploit this same subjectivity mercilessly. Rationality is defined by objectivity, generality, and steadiness, creative and volatile. Emotions arise above all when circumstances change and perceptions shift. Rationality entails duration, consistency, and regularity. It prefers stable conditions. The neoliberal economy, increasingly dismantling continuity and progressively integrating instability in order to enhance productivity, is pushing the emotionalization of productive forces forward. Accelerated communication also promotes its emotionalization. Rationality is slower than emotionality. It has no speed, as it were. Thus, the pressure of acceleration now is leading to a dictatorship of emotion. Consumer capitalism enlists emotion in order to generate more desire and need. Emotional design molds emotions and shapes emotional patterns for the sake of maximizing consumption. All in all, today, we do not consume things as much as emotions. In disciplinary society, where one's task is to function, emotions represent disturbances. Accordingly, every effort is made to weed them out. Disciplinary society's concerted orthopedy seeks to make a shapeless mass of dough into an unfeeling machine. Machines function best when all emotions and feelings have been switched off. The boom in emotion today stems, not least of all, from a new immaterial mode of production in which communicative interaction plays an ever greater role. It calls not just for cognitive competence, but also for emotional competence. Hahn maintains that the paradigm shift is taking place at the administrative level of companies. Emotions are being granted more and more significance. Rational management techniques are being replaced by emotional management. Managers today are leaving the principle of rational action behind. Increasingly, they resemble motivation coaches. Motivation connects with emotion. Positive emotions provide the ferment that makes motivations grow. Emotions are performative insofar as they call forth certain actions. As inclinations, they represent the energetic, the sensory, or even sensuous basis for action. Emotions are steered by the limbic system, which is also where the drives are seated. They form the pre-reflexive, half-conscious, physio-instinctual level of action that escapes full awareness. Neoliberal psychopolitics seizes on emotion in order to influence action on this pre-reflexive level. By way of emotion, it manages to cut and operate deep inside. As such, emotions afford a highly efficient medium for psychopolitically steering the integral person, the person as a whole. It's called gamification. Chapter 10. According to Hahn, in order to heighten productivity, emotional capitalism also enlists playing and games, which should, in fact, be the other of work, its opposite. Emotional capitalism is gamifying the life and working world. Playing games lend an emotional, indeed, a dramatic change to working, which in turn generates more motivation. Because games rapidly deliver a sense of success and reward, the result is higher performance and a greater yield. A person playing a game being emotionally invested is much more engaged than a worker who acts rationally or is simply functioning. Games exhibit a specific temporality marked by immediate experience of success and reward. But what matures over time cannot be gamified. Whatever is long, anything that lasts a long time, proves incompatible with game's temporality. Hunting, for instance, matches the mode of game, whereas farming, which depends on slow process of ripening and quiet growth, cannot be gamified at all. Life cannot be turned into hunting alone. According to Hahn, the gamification of work exploits our playfulness. The player subjugates him or herself to the order of domination in the very act of playing. Today, the gamification logic of likes, friends, and followers means that social communication is also being plugged into and subordinated to a game mode. The corollary of gamification of communication is its commercialization. That said, this process is destroying human communication. Hahn next turns to the disappearance of human labor. Following the microelectronic revolution, the argument goes, the production of wealth has grown increasingly detached from laboring and toiling. Yet at the same time, society has never been so thoroughly committed to work in a time that, in actual fact, is only making labor more and more superfluous. The political left in particular has historically exalted labor. Not only has it declared work the essence of human being, more still, it has mystified labor and pronounced it the opposite principle of capital. The left does not view work itself as scandal, only its exploitation. For this reason, the manifesto concludes, the program of all workers' party has always been simply the liberation of labor instead of liberation from labor. Labor and capital, then, represents two sides of the same coin. Ultimately, Marx himself adhered to the primacy of labor. The increase of free time, he contends, reacts back upon the power of labor as itself the greatest productive power. But with that, the realm of necessity comes to colonize the realm of freedom. Idle time, as time for higher activity, transforms its possessor into a different subject with greater productive force than one who merely toils. Excuse me. In modern parlance, more leisure time means increased human capital. Idleness that might otherwise be devoted to activities free of purpose and constraint are integrated into operations of the capital. Human beings are now transforming themselves into capital. In contrast, true freedom would be possible only if life were entirely freed from capital, which represents a new form of transcendence. The transcendence of capital stands in the way of life, in the way of life as immanence. One more time. The transcendence of capital stands in the way of life as immanence. I guess that could be interpreted many different ways, but I think it may mean when we worship capital and see our happiness in relation to it, we will find it difficult to find meaning and worth in everyday life happenings and in human relations. Hahn argues that contrary to Marx's assumption, the dialectic between forces of production and relations of production is not leading to freedom. More than anything else, it's entangling us in exploitation along new lines. We would have to think with Marx beyond Marx in order to make freedom, indeed, time that is free, our own. It could only come from the other of work, a wholly other force that no longer serves production or admits transformation into any kind of workforce at all. In other words, freedom could only come from a mode of living that is no longer a mode of production, indeed, from something altogether unproductive. The course our future takes will depend on whether we prove able, beyond the world of production, to make use of the useless. The human being is a creature of luxury, Hahn argues. In the original authentic sense, luxury is not a practice of consumption. Rather, it means a mode of living that is free of necessity. Freedom is based on deviation, getting away from necessity. Luxury transcends the intention of averting needs. But today, consumption is co-opting even luxury. Excessive consumption amounts to unfreedom, compulsion corresponding to unfreedom of labor. Luxury as freedom, like play that is truly free, can be thought only beyond the world of work and consumption. Viewed in this light, it stands close to asceticism. True happiness comes from what runs riot. Let's go is exuberant and loses meaning. The excessive and the superfluous, that is, it comes from what luxuriates, what has taken leave of all necessity, work, performance, and purpose. But today, even excess is being pocketed by capital, which strips it of its emancipatory potential entirely. What is more, playing and games belong to luxury too. But as play that is not yoked to the process of labor and production. As a means of production, gamification is destroying play's potential to set free. But Hahn argues that play should make it possible to use things in a wholly different way. It should liberate them from the theology and teleology of capital. There are two forms of thinking, thinking at work and thinking at play. The conceptions of advance by Hegel and Marx are governed by the principle of work. Likewise, Heidegger's being and time is still bound to working. In its care or anxiety, Dasein does not play. Only later did Heidegger discover play, which is based on releasement. In this light, he came to interpret the world itself as play. Now he sought out the open of the free space, hardly surmised and heeded, in which being come into play as such. Heidegger's time, play, space gestures toward a time space free of labor in any form. Okay. Here's a public service message for you. All right, I think we're having a little problem. I'm going to have to find a song to play. So I hope you bear with me. Okay. We have YouTube up. All right. I hope the next DJ will show up soon. There we go. Okay, let's see. Thank you.
close your eyes. Rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes and I will close mine. Close your eyes. Let's pretend that we're both counting sheep. Close your eyes. Oh, this is divine music play. Something dreamy for dancing while we're here romancing. It's love's holiday and love will be our guide. Close your eyes. When you open them, dear, I'll be near by your side. So won't you close your eyes?
Orice bărbat te dorești.